Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining me today. It's a lovely sunny day in Uri, and I am delighted to have Kieran Moyna, solicitor from Phoenix Law, with me in the studio. Welcome, Kieran.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
You've taken time out of your busy Friday to join us to talk about your work. Yeah. And you're not the first we've had from Phoenix Law. We've had quite a few of your colleagues in, and hopefully we'll have a few more coming down to Uri to
meet
and greet us, which is fantastic. There's so much to go through with your career and your journey and case highlights. We possibly couldn't cover it all today, so we'll have a chat about some of the key moments. But firstly, take us back in time and let us know what took you into law, what was your career journey like, and how or who inspired you to become a lawyer?
Yeah, well, thank you very much. It's not that there was anyone in particular that inspired law. I went to a secondary school, St. Joseph's, that I now sit on the Board of Governors, and it's lovely to see that from that side. But I got a D in my 11 plus. I was diagnosed dyslexic, and I went to this secondary school, and the teachers were just fantastic. And I went on and did my A-levels there, and one of my A-levels was sociology. And I had a teacher, Miss Lestrange, who is now still vice principal and still sees me, and I still feel like a five-year-old student when I see her in the school. She taught sociology. I'm so passionate about it. And obviously sociology talked about social norms, rules, laws, and how to affect change and what happened in society. And I got really interested in that. Yeah. And then when doing my UCAS form, I kind of remember picking up a perspectives and having to go through it and say, well, what leads into a profession or what leads into a career?
Yeah.
Very calculated. Mm-hmm. And obviously didn't do sciences or weren't smart enough for medicine, and certainly wasn't going to do engineering. And law just stood out as that one. And I didn't know much about it.
Yeah.
So I did a joint honours in law and marketing in University of Ulster. And the reason why I did that was because my mum was petrified that I was not going to succeed as a law degree, because maybe there was a lot of reading and there certainly was no family in the law, and it was all going to be very complicated. So that's why I did the joint honours, because you could always switch round your minor to a major.
Yeah.
And they always thought I'd be good in business or marketing. Mm. And at that stage, I was working in that kind of thing as well. So that was the backup plan, and that's how I found law.
Yeah, brilliant. And I suppose the firm that you work in is quite well known for a lot of the cases, quite high profile cases. Yeah. Most recently, I know they've been associated with working on the Stardust Inquiry, which is huge, but that's not the only one. But I guess before we get into some of your cases, what's your kind of day-to-day work like? What areas do you really specialise in?
Yeah, so Phoenix is chaos, but really positive chaos.
Yeah.
There's never a dull moment. We are so privileged with the work that comes in the door. But primarily what I do is family law.
Okay.
And I am on the Children's Order panel, and then I'm also on the Guardian Ad Litem panel. So a lot of public law, social services involved in cases, and then a lot of private law matters. So that's my bread and butter. And then there's a sideline of a bit of crime, and that would be complex, serious crimes. And then the judicial review as a third backup line, and there's injunctions and everything else in the middle. Just a day-to-day high street practice.
The other, I suppose some of the cases, there's so many to list, as I said, that I was looking through, but some of them had quite a lot of coverage with the media, I guess, as well. And a lot of your work focuses on advocating and campaigning, as well as carrying your cases through for issues in Northern Ireland around same-sex marriage and, of course, abortion reform in Northern Ireland. Can you take us through maybe some of your casework that kind of feeds into the advancement of those areas and has fed into that here?
Well, I think, you know, when we're looking at strategic litigation, it's so important. You know, all lawyers have a very particular set of skills, and you know, we have to do justice to our communities, and we are part of the community and we live in communities. So obviously I have a very close connection with the LGBT community. I act for all the LGBT charities in Northern Ireland, and therefore you know, that's my passion, and I am privileged enough to act in cases that support and advance those rights. And I think strategic litigation is quite unique, and there's a particular way of doing it. And that really was seen through the same-sex marriage Petition X case, where it was law was one strand, and media was another strand, and that's why, you know, the media really distill and spread the news that comes from courts. It makes it accessible, and you know, that's not something lawyers are good at. Now we try to be good at it. We try explaining things, and that's why, you know, we're not glory hunters. We're out explaining things in media and doing loads of media, because that's when society learn what the courts are imposing or what the wrongs or rights are, and then, you know, that can change opinions. When it comes to the strategic litigation, and I always, we really put a format on the same-sex marriage case, and it was a three-strand approach. And the first one was hearts and minds, and we really wanted a strategy to win hearts and minds, to get society behind this issue. This wasn't an LGBT issue. It wasn't a divisive issue. It wasn't one to set up against the churches. This was an equality issue embedded in human rights. So we had a lot of modelling and forming arguments as to why this is important for families. We learned quickly, you know, if you're looking to advance LGBT rights, or we're looking to do about same-sex, or you know, bring about same-sex marriage, it wasn't get the couple that wanted to be married in a picture by themselves. It was show them in their workplace, show them with their family, show them with their nephews and nieces or their children. And that really, I'd always say, personalizes the prejudice. It's really hard to hold a prejudice when you can personally relate to someone. So we made it accessible. So that hearts and minds really brought the societal campaign. And that's where all the big marches, March for Equality, came about. I was sick of marching by the end of that campaign. There were so many of them. When you can only do so much walking to the city centre or Stormont. The second then theme in the strategic campaign was politics, and that was trying to use the political system to bring about law, as they should do. That, you know, that's their primary task, and that was therefore, you know, writing to politicians, getting MPs on board, engaging on, and in the hope that legislation could be brought about, and therefore there was no need for cases. And I think all politicians are busy, and all politicians get a lot of competing rights. You know, every policy person is writing to them saying their policy is the most important thing. And therefore, I think what we learned with politicians was, if you want them to do something, do as much as you can for them. So we drafted the draft legislation that went to the Assembly. We gave them briefing notes. We gave them statistics, you know, and that was a whole other aspect of the campaign that ultimately succeeded. Now obviously there was the votes in the Assembly and the fall of the Assembly in the middle of it. You couldn't write the stuff that happened, and then it obviously went to Westminster, and that's where, you know, Conor McGinn took up the baton. And when they were adding on the private questions, we were drafting those, because that's how, you know, you're getting the change. And then the final strand of that strategic litigation campaign was the litigation
itself.
And that's the, and I think that's the high end, you know, targeted campaign, embedding it in human rights and making a court say, well, is this something we can do if politicians aren't acting? And in Northern Ireland, I always say it is the place to be a public lawyer or a human rights lawyer, because unfortunately, our Assembly and the setup is incapable of bringing about legislation very often in equality issues. You know, you've got the petition of concern, or you've just got a lack of ability to move legislation. And I hope that changes, but it hadn't been like that and hasn't been like that. So the third strand of litigation is where we see the movement. And that's, you know, everyone says courts should be a remedy of last resort, but very often in Northern Ireland, it's the only remedy.
Of course,
and that's where we have really developed and bringing cases forward.
So quite different to the marriage referendum in the South, which I suppose formed part one and part two of that. Your campaign would have been the only tools that was needed.
Lawyers shouldn't have been involved.
So you had to go to part three, of course, with your litigation itself. And you were working off what had already been achieved in London. So we were so behind in that sense, because I think it was getting a declaration to be declared valid, which had already happened in London. So it just shows you.
It's so frustrating, because in London they brought about the legislation for equal marriage, and the minister that was responsible for that said, you know, we can't be backwards. We are a modern society and we want to recognise this. And they did that. But then they came to the Northern Ireland Court and defended the non-recognition here, and that it wasn't necessary, and that we obviously seem to have different norms or cultural values here, which is just simply not the case. And when we were looking at bringing, you know, in strategic litigation, you often get one chance only, and it has to be the best chance. So you just can't go and find any couple that want to get married. We wanted to find the best possible case, and that's why some people get confused that it was called Petition X, because it wasn't JR 666 or whatever, you know. It was a petition, and so it wasn't a judicial review. It was an application in the family court, in the family division of the High Court, to declare a marriage as valid. So we found a couple that went from Northern Ireland to London, got married, and then returned back to Northern Ireland, and they wanted their application was to declare their marriage as valid and subsisting in Northern Ireland. And I remember Mr. Justice O'Hara asking the government, so when they take off at Heathrow and land in Northern Ireland, where does their marriage convert to a civil partnership? And we thought that was the best way to frame this of, you know, they're already married. When's the downgrade happening, or why is it? And is that justified? Rather than saying, we're issuing a judicial review, this couple want to be married, and you have to allow them to marry, because that's a higher bar. Yeah. And there was European case law saying, you know, there was no huge consensus across Europe that all European states were allowing for same-sex marriage, and therefore each member had a margin of appreciation that was quite wide. And we didn't think that had prospects of success as well as the Petition X. And that's really, you know, a lot of work goes, you know, you just can't find anyone. A lot of work goes into finding the perfect candidate, because it's so strategic, it's so high stakes.
Yeah.
And before you know it, something, you know, any case that, you know, it is strategic, but you've got one client and you can become very focused on the client, before you know it, there's a huge pile of people coming out of the woodwork telling you that this is really important to them. And a case that springs to mind recently is JR159. And that was where I acted for a child, Freddie. And Freddie was born prematurely, 3 weeks premature. And that made him fall into the school dates around July. So he was born premature 3 weeks early, but it was on the last day that he would then have to start P1 as essentially a 3 year, turning four. Yeah. So he was extremely young and he just wasn't ready for it.
Of course.
And his parents came and said, you know, we have no deferral system. He's not ready for P1. This is going to be a disaster. Mm. So again, we wrote to the Department of Education and said, you know, Freddie's not ready for this. We got a psych report. His behavioural issues, he's coped, or he hasn't coped well with his transition from parenting into preschool. The transition to P1's informal education is going to be too much for him. And Northern Ireland has the youngest age of start in Europe for schooling. So brought about the judicial review, it went to full hearing, and ultimately we won and got a deferral system brought into Northern Ireland.
Brilliant.
And he was able to have another year in preschool and defer his primary one. And now across the board, people that don't think their children are ready or there's issues there, they can defer their primary one. There's a whole mechanism brought in, which is really easy. But that had huge significance. And there was charities campaigning for that and doing policy documents for years and getting nowhere, because it wasn't a major thing on political agenda. Yeah. But it took that one child. Yeah. And, you know, before you know it, everyone's writing to
you. Yeah. So a huge change there. And another example, I suppose, where Northern Ireland was lagging was in relation to the recognition of gender recognition certificates.
Yeah.
And I know that was dealt with in one of your cases where it covered barriers to transgender people in Northern Ireland securing official acknowledgement of their preferred identity. And that was JR111, which, you know, I think it settled in some way. Well, it really, but it really turned a corner and would have impacted many, many people who were affected by that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So gender services in Northern Ireland are dire, and people that need help and access to medical services are put on wait lists, and very often, so we've got COI, K-O-I, Knowing Our Identity, and that's the adolescent and junior services in Knockbracken, and then there's an adult service, and sometimes, you know, you've got children going through CAMHS that go on to the gender service wait list, and they age out of that and then go on to the adult service and wait. So it's not a positive experience. And what we were doing in JR 111 was people want to apply for a gender recognition certificate, and that gender recognition certificate changes their birth certificate. They're allowed to have a new birth certificate that has their preferred gender on it, and it seals their own old birth certificate. But to apply to the gender recognition panel, you have to do this large application form, and you need a statutory declaration done by a solicitor, and then you need two medical reports, one from your GP saying that you have a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, and one from a medical expert in the field of gender, so normally a consultant that's working in gender. Now, if you're on a wait list, you don't have access to that consultant or that specialist, so you can't get a diagnosis or you can't get the medical report form. This lady who took the application in JR 111 said, well, I'm not dysphoric. I don't believe I have gender dysphoria. This is negative. I don't want that I have a disorder. So we don't, first of all, I don't meet that. So I don't want that criteria. I don't meet that criteria. So I'm going to be ineligible. And secondly, I'm no longer willing to wait on wait lists. I don't want any surgery. I don't want any counselling. I've lived in my preferred gender for 14 years. So I don't have access to a consultant. So they would never be able to change their birth certificate. So that case proceeded, and the outcome of it was that the gender dysphoria was removed from the Gender Recognition Act, and it was changed to gender incongruence, and that's significant for a lot of people. And then the second thing was there was a memorandum of understanding done where if you were on a wait list, they would allow you a consultation to get the medical report done by the consultant. And if you weren't engaged with any services but wanted the report, the trust would fund that report. Because previously, I'd known people that were flying to London with a suitcase of their GP notes and records, booking a private appointment and paying £700 for a report. So that there's now a whole service provision in that you can go and get that application, and that then allows you to apply. And, you know, it might sound like a really minor thing getting a new birth certificate, but you have to have your birth certificate when you're getting a license, when you're applying for a mortgage, when you're opening a bank account. And these people find that forms that don't represent them are just having to, they're having to disclose a gender history, and they're traumatic, and a lot of them destroy the forms. And so, you know, it was hugely significant. And that is a wave of litigation I see coming. We just see the trans debate getting more toxic. I don't think in North, we haven't got to the levels that may be in South or in England and Wales, but it's certainly destructive. And unfortunately, I do see litigation, or not, fortunately, maybe litigation will bring about understanding, but I suppose when we look at the media, there's no safe space to have those discussions. It all goes to polarised extremes. It's so toxic.
It really is.
And it's so upsetting. It's just, you know, and it kind of creates a chill effect for strategic litigation because you need the brave people to put their names forward, to give your their evidence, invest in the case. You know, we have to have victim status for judicial review to invoke human rights. And therefore, there's charities that would love to take these cases. The Rainbow Project would go and fight for the trans community every day of the week. But
of course,
that that they need someone to come up and put their name up. And with such toxicity in society, those people are less willing to do that.
Yeah.
And I understand why. It's a hard...
It really is. And people are so brave. And I think you're right. It's really, it's awful to have somebody, you know, having the victim status to bring such a case. But it's only through the strategic litigation that you see how people are impacted.
Yeah.
And just reading through your case there, which was the J.O.R., on gender recognition, you really see how somebody's impacted.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily see that when you're listening to campaigns, no matter how supportive you are of those campaigns. No. It's only really when you see how somebody has been really traumatized and having to disclose all of their information as well. It's difficult. But as you say, it's important, you know, to move matters on. So it does show that the strategic litigation working hand in hand, I guess, with, you know, the charities and all of the other campaigns that are going on is a positive thing and necessary, I think.
And I think you've got, like, you know, they talk about the judicial cloak, and you know, when something is decreed by a high court judge, you know, if you ask anyone on the street in society, judges are very smart. They know the law, they know what's right, they're held with huge regard, and therefore it legitimizes and calms things down when a judge says, no, this is a breach of human rights and no, this is not acceptable. You know, then they go, all right, okay, well, we might need to relook at that, and our the media are more willing to do explainers and get down to facts and hear real voices.
Absolutely, which is important. Well, well done on that work. And as you say, you see more of that coming through, which we will watch alongside yourselves who'll be working on it. Now, another big case that you're very much associated with and we've all followed will be Lee versus Asher's Bakery.
Yes.
The Asher's case, I think it's the gay marriage.
The gay cake
case.
The only cake that I've never known to have a gender identity.
Yeah. You still like cake. Because you were working on it. It was quite intense, I'd imagine. But how did you get involved? Because I know it was going on for some time before you became involved.
Gareth Lee went to purchase a cake in a bakery that he used regularly, and service was refused ultimately. He went to the Equality Commission to seek advices, and they issued the county court proceedings, and they ran in Belfast County Court, and there was a Her Honour Judge Brownlee presided over those, and it went on for a long time, and the gallery was packed on a daily basis. And I think that was mainly because Asher's were supported by the Christian Institute, and the Christian Institute was rocking out a lot of media, a lot of press, and was nearly doing trial by media, I would say.
Yes.
So it got a lot of attention, and unfortunately, most of that attention was wrong. You know, you got extremes, comparisons, examples that were way out there. You know. It was they even angered me, you know, halal butchers having to serve pork and things like that. You know, there was just so many bad examples and extremes being made.
Yeah.
But yeah, went to the county court, then was appealed to the Court of Appeal, and it was upheld. So Gareth won in the county court, won in the Court of Appeal. Then the Attorney General made a reference and referred to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court came to Belfast, the first time they ever came to Belfast. They decided they were going on tours, so they were sat in Belfast, they sat in Scotland, and that's the case they heard in the old bar library. And they heard that and overturned the two judgments in Supreme Court. That is when I became instructed, because the Equality Commission couldn't continue on, and we made the application to Europe. And ultimately, that created another news storm. After that judgment in the Supreme Court, and ultimately the European Court came back not accepting it, and it never went any further, and it's hugely frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I think when we're talking about society, business, and services you provide in a marketplace, the bright line, the clear rule was you cannot discriminate on protective grounds against people. You know, you can't have a business that is got particular religious aspects, or you can't have a gym that has particular sexual orientation aspects, or, you know, women and men. There's very clear examples, and unfortunately what I feel the Supreme Court judgment does has, it's created uncertainty, yeah. and it's blurred that bright line mm-hmm. rule. And we're not sure now whether businesses have religious identities. Mm-hmm. So Ashers were justified because they had strong religious beliefs.
Yeah.
And I still can't really fathom how mm-hmm. a limited company can have that. Mm-hmm. And I now get calls where there was a printer that didn't want to print a Pride magazine because he was the business had certain views on LGBT. Mm-hmm. We had a gym that didn't want to accept a trans person, and because of their deeply held views in respect of gender and how females wow. are females and males are males mm-hmm. and it's binary. So that used to be very straightforward advice.
Yeah.
Used to say no. Bright line rule, goods for the lead services, yeah. cannot discriminate. Supreme Court judgment mm-hmm. can now be relied upon, and I think there will be test cases or
yeah,
further
I was gonna say,
other
how
examples.
Can we?
I think employ you know, yeah. the graphic designer who mm-hmm. doesn't want to work on a show where a non-binary person is, doesn't want to edit it because they don't believe in that.
Yeah.
You know, we've got all these examples and they come to me and I'm saying, right, well, you know, this is what the law is saying, and they near die, and they don't yeah. want to be part of a test case. They don't want to have to go and re-challenge. So there's a real chill effect, and there's an uncertainty mm-hmm. now as a result of that.
Yeah.
And I find that case very frustrating. I find that the public debate was very one-sided or limited. And I still don't think society, our lawyers did a good job in explaining to society what that case was actually about.
Yeah. God, it is such wide ramifications, as you say, for so many areas of our society yeah. and industry. How do we compare in that regard to other parts of the UK? Do you think this is quite Northern Ireland centric in terms of the kind of closure of the matter? And
I think because our political history, you know, we got into, well, what if a nationalist party goes to a loyalist printer?
We got
back into the green and orange really easily yeah. on Ashers, and therefore I think there is a particular, and then with the negativity around same-sex marriage at that time going on as well, it was just a very good, and it was a complicated case to understand indirect discrimination and things yeah. like that. I don't think England and Wales is as complicated or gets as exercised about it, and I think there's a lot more leeway. I did hear that the photographer that was instructed by the other side in the Supreme Court then refused to provide his pictures because he said, well, when this judgment came out, well, I don't agree with your position, so you're not getting my services now. Wow. It's very petty. But no, England, Wales, it was a big deal in America. There was cakes and weddings and registrars not wanting to do same-sex marriages. So America had a lot of it, and there's a good number of judgments arising from that.
So at the moment in Northern Ireland, it probably falls with the charities and the campaign groups to lobby on it or to kind of raise the issue. But as an effective remedy, we're kind of stuck a little bit.
Yeah, the law is still there, the legislation is still there, but it now has to be interpreted in this Supreme Court judgment.
Right.
And, it's a long way up to take on a Supreme Court judgment, and especially one that Lady Hale wrote.
Yeah.
So, you know, it would have to, you know, you'd really have to get factual,
absolutely,
the facts on point and take it through.
But nonetheless, a huge case and drawing attention to problems that we still have here in society, really, is what we can read from it. With all of that and all of your other cases, can you name any highlights, or one highlight or a couple, with your casework, or any kind of the successes that you've had in your cases?
It's so hard. Yeah. Like, you know, professionally, you know, I've had highlights when I started business, when I joined Phoenix, when I was appointed as a deputy court judge. You know, they're all really professional highlights that I absolutely can't get over still. In terms of the cases, I find it really hard to identify one case that beats the rest, because behind all these cases and all these numbers that I can never remember, all these
the JR
numbers, they're getting worse, and you've got 89 and 189, and
I couldn't cope with
I know faces and names, I can just never get numbers, but with all those numbers, stand behind them individuals.
Yeah.
And they're so brave. They have put their head above the parapet. They have come to us. They're willing to tell their personal stories, and they're willing to go through the roller coaster, which what is strategic litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in awe of them, and it's such a privilege to act for each and every one of them. So, and they come with such different baggage. Some have had really negative experiences and need the change to justify existence. Some come angry and want to make the change, and some just know it's wrong and they're going to do better for the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, the marriage cases, humanist marriage, same-sex marriage, they all sit in the block. The 11 plus case, the deferral of P1, the education cases, they all sit in the block. And one client that really comes to mind when I'm talking about these things is Laura Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And Laura Lee was a sex worker in the UK. And when Northern Ireland and Lord Morrow and his private members bill was seeking to criminalise the payment of sex, she gave evidence, rose above the parapet, identified herself to the media, gave evidence before the assembly, and then took a case on saying, this is going to make it more dangerous. This law is dangerous. It won't work. And this is why. And she was such a brave person to do that. And she was shunned and she received a terrible time. And unfortunately, she took her life during the litigation. And that's certainly, I can tell you, that's the lowest part of my career.
My goodness, yeah.
But when I look back and reflect, it was also a privilege to act for.
Yeah.
And a really high part that she came to me and did that and really took on the state. And I have every confidence that she would have succeeded in her JR had she got to a hearing. But 5 years on after that legislation was implemented, Queen's University did a research on the implementation of the law and the effectiveness of it. And everything she claimed was wrong and wasn't going to work and was going to endanger life, they said was true. It was statistically right, and the lived experience of sex workers in Northern Ireland was all right, and the law didn't make it better.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a real vindication for her, and I know she knows that, so I'm delighted about that. But it's strategic litigation is exhausting and quite the roller coaster of emotions. So you can, you know, high moments can always come with low moments. Like, you know, I remember
at the same time,
just really quickly, the humanist marriage case. It was Laura Lacole and Eunan O'Kane, famous model, famous footballer, and they wanted this humanist marriage in Galgorm, and we were down to the wire on time. We got an expedited hearing, and we won at first instance in the High Court before Mr. Justice Colton. Great judgment. And we went to Bullet that afternoon for lunch when we got the judgment.
Lovely.
And as we were having lunch, the notice of appeal came in from the Attorney General. Wow. So, you know, from such a high down to a crashing no, and then back to work to get onto the Court of Appeal before the wedding.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's always crazy.
Oh,
It's always a really complex question, the answer.
It is. I'm not surprised. And I suppose my next one is even more complex after you've just mentioned that, which is really, how do you, with all of your work and those quite heavy cases and quite challenging cases and your day-to-day work as well, how do you switch off, or is there a moment where you finish the day and say, right, that's it, I'm done for the day, and sit back? I can't quite imagine it, but I'm wondering how you, or do you achieve some kind of balance?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the other Phoenix ones say, but there is no work-life balance.
They said the same.
Yeah, this is life. This is, and when I'm speaking to paralegals that are in my department, you know, it's not a 9-to-5 job.
No.
You're not finishing at 5. You're not getting lunch at 1 to 2. You're not going to have balance. This is an absolute passion. It's an absolute way of life. And you have to try, or I have to try getting some balance.
Yeah.
But I don't succeed, and I'm never done being shouted at. My mother's always telling me I'm tired and worried about me.
Aww.
My other half thinks I'm insane for working, and everyone in the office probably thinks I'm mad. But the one thing in recent times that I've really tried doing is I now, I'm trying back swimming and I'm at CrossFit, and I put them in my diaries as appointments in the evening. Because if I have an appointment at 6:30, then I can't put a client in, or I can't squeeze another Zoom in, or I can't sit on at the desk.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get regimented with the diary is the only thing that brings about a bit of balance.
Good, it's important. I think your colleague Gavin,
generally,
he was a CrossFit advocate as well, so there might be something there for...
Because it's another level of insanity, yeah, you know, just going mad in the gym.
Yeah. It's not quite relaxing and chilling out, you know, after your hard day's work. But I suppose you've won so many awards outside of work. I'm not able to name them all.
And I'm not going to want you to.
Humanist of the Year and many awards around. You've got the National Diversity Award as well. And the question, I suppose, the reason why this podcast was set up was around, you know, the derogatory slurs against activist lawyers.
Yeah.
And we kind of took that title and here we are with our podcast.
Yeah.
But what does it mean to you? I mean, some human rights lawyers, I guess, and some that we've had here are, you know, focus on their work. And that they do a lot of hard work through their litigation and they achieve results.
Yeah.
But how important is it for you, or is it important that activism, I mean, you've given examples already, can affect changes within the law and vice versa? And
completely. Yeah. I just don't see how we aren't activists. Our people sit back and be passive and just take whatever cases that come in.
Yeah.
You know, Gavin's in the legacy computer community.
Mm-hmm.
Claire is in the historical institutional abuse and Muckmore and all the state abuse. Sinead is doing great work in immigration, and I don't know how she's the focal point for that.
She is.
You know, Dara and the Stardust families, how you couldn't come attached to what them stories, them families experienced and their experiences. You know, we're empathetic and we can just associate with communities, and I think that's what we're good at, and that's important. And when you have those lived experiences, shared lived experiences, then you understand the case more. And you're bought in and you want to work harder, and it's not a slur.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't change it. And I think as I said at the start, you know, we have a certain expertise or skill set. Do good with it.
Yeah.
Use it as the best, to the best of your ability.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, when I'm talking about judicial review, when someone comes in and tells me what's going on, the first thing I always think is like the gut feel test. Does it seem wrong? In your gut, is that wrong? Mm-hmm. And if it is, then you can normally find something to challenge.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, when you understand what that person's lived experiences are, then you can advocate for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great that, you know, we can be a voice to these people, but it's more important to give them their voice.
Sure.
And,
absolutely.
You know, that's what we're trying to do. And if someone wants to say that's activism, then fair enough.
Yeah.
And it's only a strand of activism.
Sure.
You know, there's so many other strands that we can come and be a part of. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the three-strand approach in same-sex marriage. If political systems were more effective,
we wouldn't need to be as active. No, absolutely. But the examples that you've given today show how the two work together and complement each other, I guess. And just for our listeners, anyone who's listening who wants to follow in your footsteps and do the type of work that you're doing, and I'm sure there'll be many, what advice would you have for them initially?
When you're studying,
mm-hmm.
Pick practical examples when you're writing dissertations or master's theses or whatever it is. So at Ulster University, there is a science shop. I don't know why they call it the science shop, but it's where it links you with community organisations to make your work worthwhile. So when I was doing my law degree, my dissertation was on the effectiveness of Civil Partnership Act. And I linked with the Rainbow Project.
Brilliant.
And therefore they were able to get a free law student to do a piece of research
Brilliant.
For them.
Yeah.
And then they were able to take my dissertation and distill that down into policy documents, things. When I was doing my master's in criminal justice at Queen's, my dissertation was on comparing the 1921 inquiries legislation to the new inquiries legislation, I think it's 2005. And CAJ partnered with them and they used it.
Brilliant.
So, you know, make law is not academic. It shouldn't be book studying or desktop research. You know, try getting into as much practical experience as you can. When it comes to work, you know, a lot of people, I think, are doing masters or further education, which is important, but, you know, that has to have an element to it. So like the Masters in Clinical Legal Education at Ulster, they're doing tribunals, they're given benefit appeal
Brilliant.
Rights. You know, that will just found, or give you foundations in terms of advocacy or writing skills, because when you're applying to do the work that maybe Phoenix and type of work that I do, it's a high street practice, it's legal aid practice, and times are difficult, and therefore there's not much leeway to just take on someone with no experience and expect them to qualify as a solicitor in 2 years' time. You know, they need to be giving adding value to the business. So any experience they have in family law, citizens advice bureau, clinical education and representation really does give that added value when they come in, they hit the ground running. And showing passion in human rights is what it's all about.
It is, and we can really see it with you and your colleagues as well. Well, Kieran, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you about your work. I've been wanting to do it for some time now, so we finally got you into the studio.
Thank you. Delighted. No, it's really a pleasure being down here. Real honour, and I'm delighted to be here. It's a much calmer environment than what I'm used to on a Friday.
You can stay here for the day.
I might.
And chat. We can chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for joining me today. If you like the show, please remember to share and leave a review if you have a moment. And you can also check out our website, www.activistlawyer.com, where you will see some blog articles written by our guests and contributors, as well as some fabulous Activist Lawyer merchandise.
This podcast was recorded in Granite Podcast Studio. Interested in starting up your own podcast but don't know how? Granite Podcast Studio can help. Record your podcast in our state-of-the-art studio, which is based in the heart of Newry City. Our studio has cutting-edge and user-friendly technology and can seat up to four people. We also provide an editing service for our team, using your guidance and editing notes to provide you with a flawless finished product, leaving your listeners wanting more. For more information on how you can get started, visit www.granitepodcaststudio.com.